through this too. And we're in Daniel 11, and we've been struggling to get through this. A very rich, although it's only 45 verses, he covers, I don't know how many years, about 400 years of history here, and tells Daniel ahead of time what is going to happen to his people. And we've been through a lot of it, and we remember when we came to verse 21, a new character comes on the scene by the name of Antiochus Epiphanes. And although God doesn't give his name in the chapter, any of the Jews living through understand Antiochus Epiphanes, the most cruel king of Syria, the one who persecuted the nation Israel, verse 21, was a vile person. And he came in peaceably, said he'd be their friend, and used all types of flatteries. And then in verse 22, he used his armies to overflow and did a lot of damage down there. And we've been reading through and observing it, and we've been using secular history sources that confirm all of this, because God doesn't give the names. I guess there's a book called the Book of Maccabees, which was written a couple hundred years after Christ, and it was written, I'm going to assume, by a Jew. And he wrote about Judas Maccabee, who we're going to get to in a few minutes. And he's the one that is said, the people that know their God, and the verse 32, shall be strong and do exploits. And that's talking about Judas Maccabee and his four brothers and the father and the grandfather and the work they did in standing up for the nation Israel and finally running Antiochus out. And it's covered in the works of Josephus, and we were working with that. And I'll read you a little bit more history. I have a Dave Hunt's book, and he quotes Will and Ariel Durant, who wrote that big The Story of Civilization, which is about 11 volumes. And in volume 2, The Life of Greece, he's got a number, a bit of the history here on Antiochus and how he went to Jerusalem and slaughtered the Jews, and talks about it here, the tragic history. And we're also going to read some work out of a Alfred Kolach, a Jewish rabbi here, and he has the Mishnah and the Megillat number 9, the Talmud and the Shabbat 21, and he has a history, Jewish history, written down, and you'll see all the confirmation of these events here that we're looking at, because the king of the north, Antiochus, comes in, and I'll read again from Dave Hunt's work and the story of a civilization by Will and Ariel Durant. And what he did was, when he finally did come in with his arms, and he slaughtered thousands of Jews, men, women, and children, he desecrated, he looted the temple, he appropriated any of the, they had collection boxes there. There was the box of Joash. You can read about this in the Book of Kings. And Joash was a king, and he wanted some more money for the temple. So he had a box put in the back of the temple with a hole in the top, and you could throw money in the box. And he raided the coffers of that box. He went in, took the golden altar. He took the golden vessels. He took the treasuries. He gave orders for the compulsory. Now, this is from Will Durant's Story of Civilization, Part 2. Compulsory Hellenization of all the Jews. Hellenization is a fancy word for trying to turn them into Greeks. And the Bible talks about the Jew and the Greek. And the reason that the New Testament will speak of that is the Jew, they were very intelligent people with writing, and the Greeks were a very intelligent Gentile people with writing and philosophy. And he was trying to convert all of them, because Antiochus had come as a grandson of one of the generals of Alexander the Great, who was the Greek leader. And he's trying to make all the Jews convert. He commanded the temple be rededicated as a shrine to the Greek god Zeus. He commanded a Greek altar be built over the old altar. This is Will Durant's writing here directly. He commanded that the usual daily Jewish sacrifices be replaced now with a sacrifice of pigs on the altar. He forbid the keeping of the Sabbath. He forbid the keeping of the Jewish feasts. He made circumcision a capital crime, and any woman that had their baby boy circumcised, they would first run the mother through, and then they would hang the baby. Throughout all of Judea, the old religion and its rites were, this is Durant saying, they were interdicted, they're against the law. And Greek ritual was made compulsory on pain of death. Every Jew who refused to eat pork or was found possessing any of the scrolls was to be jailed or killed. And whenever the book or a scroll was found, it was to be burned. The agents of Antiochus and his sergeants and generals, having put an end to all visible expression of Judaism in Jerusalem, now passed from village to village, the nearby towns and villages, like a searching fire, and wanted to burn all Judaism out. Everywhere they gave the people the choice, either participate in the Greek worship of Antiochus or face death. And you must also eat the sacrificial swine. All the synagogues and Jewish schools were closed. Those who refused to work on the Sabbath, they were told they had to work on the Sabbath, were outlawed as rebels. And on the day of the Bacchanalia feast for the Greeks, the Jews were now compelled to deck themselves in ivy, like the Greeks, to take part in the processions. They were to sing wild songs in honor of Dionysius. Many Jews just conformed to the demands, hoping the storm would soon pass. Others fled into caves or mountain retreats. They lived on clandestine gleanings from the fields, and they resolved to carry on the ordinances of Jewish life. And, of course, any women who circumcised their newborn sons were either cast through or thrown over the city walls to death, and the baby thrown with them or hung. The Greeks were then surprised, this is Durant writes, to find the strength of the old Jewish faith. Not for centuries had the Greek armies seen any such loyalty to any idea. The stories of martyrdom went from mouth to mouth, and they filled the books like 1st and 2nd Maccabees. And Judaism, which had been near assimilation, they had started following the other countries, now became intensified in the face of persecution. Persecution strengthens God's people. We don't have enough persecution in America. We need more to make Christians make a choice and stand up. We need some notices on the building, we're going to close your building, so some pastors can stand up. We need some persecution here. Whenever you're ready, guys. Okay, you come right here, 271 Bucyrus, anytime. Brother Mike, you come see me. We need some of this. And Judaism became intensified in the midst of the persecution in religious and national consciousness. That's Durand's writing. Now, going back to what Josephus had, has the armies swept out of Jerusalem, Antiochus' armies, they got Jerusalem under control, they moved to the west toward the Mediterranean Sea. And as they moved westward, on the border of the Philistine, where Gath and Gaza were, there was a town called Modin, a little town there. And there was a man by the name of John. His father was Simon, and his great-great-great-grandfather was Jehoiarib. And when you read 1 Chronicles chapter 24, and you read about the courses of the priests, the sons of Aaron, he was an Aaronic priest, the high priest, this man John. His heritage was a high priest. And in 1 Chronicles 24, it lays out the courses, the 24 courses of the priests and how they go to Jerusalem to do their service. Now, he's in a Levitical city of Modin. He has five sons. He has one son named Mattathias, who has five sons. He has five grandsons. Mattathias has five sons. John, number two, Simon, number three, Judah or Judas, number four, Eliezer, number five, Jonathan. Again, you hear the names. A good name is rather to be chosen than great riches. John, that's the grace of Jehovah. Simon, that's one that hears the Lord. Judah, that's one that praises the Lord. Eliezer, that's the my help comes from God. Jonathan, that means the gift of God. He's got five strong sons. John, the grandfather, Mattathias, the father, the five grandsons, they're older now. And here comes the priest to Modin, the army comes to Modin, and they tell all the Jews, you must do as King Antiochus has commanded. This is Josephus. This is chapter 6 of the Jewish Antiquities, book number 12 we're in. And they said, you must compulsory do the sacrifice like the king commanded. The grandpa was a little old at that point to do much, but his son Mattathias was well respected in the community. He was in his mid-40s at the time. His sons were in their 20s. And Mattathias, they said, you come up here and do the sacrifice of Antiochus. And he said, and your fellow citizens will follow you because of your father and all your sons. You're all great priests in this area. He said, I will not do it. And then he stood up and he made a speech. And he said, I will not obey the commands of Antiochus, not out of fear, not to please him. My sons are not going to do it. We're going to keep the worship of the true God. As soon as he ended his speech, one of the Jews of Modin came out and sacrificed, just like Antiochus commanded. And Mattathias had great indignation, took a sword, ran upon him, ran him through, killed that man that sacrificed, and the king's general Apelles, who compelled them to sacrifice. And like I showed you last week, this is something God likes. Numbers chapter 25, when Phinehas stood up for the glory of the Lord, and he ran a woman and a man through for doing this, a Moabitish woman, and God said, I like that man. He stood up for my glory. I'm going to give him an everlasting priesthood because he was zealous for his God. And he stood up for the children of Israel. Amen and amen. And Mattathias did the same thing. He then overthrew the altar. He cried out and he said, if any of you be zealous for the laws and the worship of God, follow me. And he hurried into the desert with his son. And many followed him and they dwelt in caves. Now, do you remember David, when he was running from Saul, did the same thing in 1 Samuel chapter 22. And I'll just read to you. And this was a rough time for the people. They were under persecution. And at the time when David was being persecuted and he departed and escaped into the cave Adullam, and many people came with him. And who came with him? People that were, this is 1 Samuel 22, verse 2. People that were in distress, that were in debt, and those that were discontented gathered themselves unto David. And, you know, that's what the world wants to do to us. It wants to make us discontented. It wants to distress us and put us in debt. And we need to gather with God's people. And they gathered with David. And here they gathered with Mattathias and his four sons. Now the king's general heard of this because, what was his name, was killed. Apelles was killed. But there was another general that heard of it from Syria. And he grabbed his forces and they pursued the Jews into the desert. And they began to fight the Jews' tactic on the Sabbath day. And the Jews at that time avoided to defend themselves because it was the Sabbath day. And so the Syrians and Antiochus' army had an opportunity, and they had about 1,000 men and women and children who were smothered and died in a cave. And then Mattathias remembered what the book of Exodus chapter 21 said. Go to Exodus 21. And Mattathias then made a speech to all the other Jews. And he taught them to fight on the Sabbath day. Because in the book of Exodus 21, when God is giving the civil law, he says in verse 12, he that smiteth a man so that the man dies shall surely be put to death. And if a man lie not in wait, but God deliver him into his hand, then I will appoint thee a place whither he shall flee. Let's just stop for a minute. You know what God's saying? I permit accidents to happen. I may permit it one day that you're out there working and you're chopping down a tree and the axe will come right off the handle and hit the guy in the head and kill him. And God said, I let that happen. I allow accidents on planet Earth. Nobody dies without my permission. Nobody dies without God's permission. There was a shooting at Tops not too long ago. God said, I wasn't surprised. I knew the guy was coming. I knew he was going to kill. I let him kill everybody. Why? If they were saved, I let them come to me. If they weren't saved, I knew they ain't going to get saved the next 40 years. They can die. Yeah, sad for you. Not sad for those of us who think like God. Who do we think we are? Who do we think we are that we have a right to live? We have a right to die from the first day we sin. That's our right. It's our right to die and go to hell. It ain't our right to live. We live by mercy. I love teaching like this. I do. I love this book. Anyways, now listen to what God says in verse 14. But if a man come presumptuously, like Antiochus army was coming, upon his neighbor to slay him with guile, you can even take him from mine altar that he may die. In other words, if that guy committed that sin and then ran to the altar of God and said, God's going to protect me, I'm praying, God said, take him away and kill him. I want him dead. There's no running to my altar after you do something like that. And Mattathias got up and said, we can fight these men on the Sabbath day. And what's his name? Josephus writing here about 90 A.D. So this is about 200 years after it happened, 240 years after it happened, says, and this rule continues among we Jews to this day. If there is a necessity, we may fight on the Sabbath. And Matthias gathered a great army of faithful Jews, and he overthrew the idol altars, and he killed those that broke the law, and he commanded the boys that they could be circumcised now. And when he had ruled for 1 year, he fell into sickness, and he called for his sons, and they gathered around him, and he said, oh, my sons, I'm now going the way of all the earth. I recommend you keep God's law, preserve the customs of Israel, recover the ancient form of government that God gave you, pursue after the glory of God. And he's giving a charge, just like Genesis 49, when Jacob gave a charge to his sons, just like David did to his son Solomon, be strong and of a good courage. And he's giving a charge to him, and he said, I'm going to die. He had five sons again. Let me get number one was John, and John wanted to be a priest. Number two was his son Simon. And he said, esteem Simon now as your father because he's a man of extraordinary wisdom. Be governed by him in his counsel. And take my third son, Judas, who's known as Maccabeus. Maccabeus means a hammer. Judas was a strong fighter. And take him to be the general for your army. And then when Mattathias died, about 3 weeks later, the people took Judas the hammer, Maccabeus, and made him the ruler of the army. And Judas cast the enemies out of the country and put those of their own country. Three things he did. Number one, the Syrians out. Number two, all that had betrayed the God of Israel, he put them to death. And number three, all the pollutions had to be taken out of the land, and he purified the land. That's chapter 7 in Josephus. The next chapter. When Apollonius, the general of the Samaritan forces north, heard, and the Samaritans had turned coat and had joined with Antiochus, he took an army and hurried to go against Judas. Judas joined the battle with him and beat him and killed many of his men. Judas then took Apollonius' sword and used it as a trophy, just like when David had killed Goliath and held up that sword for a little bit. When Sirion, who was a general of the army of southeast Syria, heard about this, he came down to Beth Horon and he pitched his camp. Judas went to meet him, but he noticed his soldiers were hesitant to fight because they were fasting towards God. He got down and prayed with his men. After the fast, he went against the Syrians and beat them, and their general fell. And so now he's taken out the Samaritans. He's taken the army of southeast Syria. When King Antiochus heard of this, he was exceeding angry. He got together as many mercenaries as he could to join his own army. But sadly, he'd been spending so much money, his treasuries were out of money. He needed something to do. He went to Persia to try and get money, and he hired a man named Lysias from Egypt. And he told Lysias, get as many men as you can. Lysias gathered men from Ptolemy's army, 40,000 foot soldiers and 7,000 horsemen. They started making their move toward Judas Maccabee. When Judas Maccabee saw the camp and how numerous the enemies were, he did like Samuel did in 1 Samuel 7. And I was reading that when Samuel had the Philistines surrounding him and the people were afraid. And the men of Kirjath-Jearim came, and they were surrounding the people. And Samuel said, he spake to all the house of Israel, and he said, here's what we need to do. Let's return to the Lord with all our heart. Let's put away the strange gods. Gather everyone together to Mizpah. And they all gathered together, and he said, let's cease not to cry unto the Lord our God, for he will save us out of the hand of the Philistines. And Judas prayed with his men, persuaded his soldiers, be of good courage, put your hopes of victory in God. And he set them in the ancient order of battle used by the forefathers Joshua, and he took their army out. And the speech encouraged the men. And one of the ways they started the battle is he commanded the trumpeters to go out front like Joshua did at Jericho and to sound the trumpet for the battle. And the enemies were shocked and they fell upon the enemies. He killed many. He pursued the rest of them as far as Gadara, Idumea, and Ashdod. And there fell in one day 3,000. And he went back to their camp because they fled and he took the spoils out of their camp. He found silver. He found gold. I think a lot of it had been stolen booty from other countries. But he got this gold, the silver. He found some fine linen of purple and blue. And he returned home with joy. They sang hymns to God for the good success. And they determined, let's rebuild the temple. Now, Lysias had escaped. And he wanted one last stand. And he gathered another 60,000 men and 5,000 horsemen, and he came to the hill country of Judea. And Judas met him, and again the men prayed to God, and they beat and killed 5,000. Lysias noticed the spirit of the Jewish fighters, how they were prepared to die rather than lose their liberty, and he got afraid, and he ran and returned to Antioch, and that was the end. And Judas assembled all the priests and the people together and said, we need to go back to Jerusalem and purify the temple. Now I got to go to the book of the rabbi to show you what happened here, because this has become famous in the history of the Jewish people. In 165 B.C., when Judas Maccabee recaptured the temple from the Syrian Greek army, they rebuilt the altar. And according to the Mishnah, Megillat number 9, the task took them 8 days to finish. Now the Talmud explains that when the Syrians had captured the temple, they had desecrated it and they had destroyed the jugs of oil. Now, the high priest was required, according to the book of Exodus, to prepare a special oil, and only one oil could be used in the golden candlestick. And it had to be consecrated, and it had to be put into a small cruse with an unbroken seal of the high priest, or it could not be used. As Judas and his men went through, they were only able to find one small cruse of oil containing only enough oil to burn the lampstand for one day. Nevertheless, they wanted to rededicate their temple, and the high priest prayed, and he kindled the menorah, and a miracle happened. The menorah flame continued to burn for 8 days until the high priest could make more consecrated oil and new cruses. And that's why Hanukkah is celebrated for 8 days. This, there was a time, I don't know, let me see if I can find it for you. It would be in 2 Kings chapter 4, where God did something like this before. You see, they fought for the glory of God. They fought for the pure and undefiled religion, the only one ever given on the planet, the one given by God to Moses. And they fought to rededicate his temple, the exceeding magnificent temple that God wanted, where his glory could be. And they fought for that reason. I remember there was a time when Elisha the prophet told one of the widows, take the oil. And it came to pass when the vessels were full, this is 2 Kings 4, verse 6, that she said to her son, bring me another vessel. And he said, there's not another vessel. And the oil stayed. And it's a picture of salvation, the oil of the Holy Spirit. Once your vessel is filled, he ain't leaving you. That's a spiritual picture, but it's also a historical picture how God made provision and the oil never went down in that vessel. And this is what happened at the Feast of Hanukkah. And this is why the Jews celebrate it for 8 days, because a cruse of oil burned for 8 days instead of only one. Now, if you go back and read your Old Testament, there are seven feasts that are given by God to the Jews in the Old Testament. They're all in the book of Leviticus 23. And in that chapter, he lays out the three feasts in the early spring. There's the Passover, the first fruits, and the unleavened bread. And then 50 days later, there's the Pentecost. That's in very late spring. And then there's the break to the fall feasts. And there's the trumpets. And I forget the other three. But and tabernacles. And another one that goes with it. And do you remember what it is? Anyways, there are three feasts there. So there's 3, 1, and 3. And those are the seven feasts given. Now, curiously, this particular feast was a miracle that God put his hand into, and Jesus celebrated it in the New Testament. John chapter 10. The Feast of Booths is Tabernacles. And that's one of the ones God gave. This is one that happened long after Leviticus in 1400 B.C. This happened in 165 B.C. And it wasn't part of the book. By then, the canon was closed. And yet, Jesus acknowledged and celebrated this feast in the Gospel of John, chapter 10. So if you go to John, chapter 10, you'll see where Jesus accepted it. This event, according to Josephus, according to the rabbis here, occurred on the 25th day of Kislew, or Kislev. I'm not sure how to pronounce the Jewish months. That is the month that begins for the Jews in what for us will be November 15th. That's the first day of Kislev. So the 25th day of Kislev is when this event occurred. So that would be like December 10th. And then it goes for 8 days. That's what they call Hanukkah. Jesus called it here, verse 22 of John chapter 10. It was in Jerusalem at the Feast of the Dedication. This is the dedication of the temple done by Judas Maccabeus and his brothers, Simon and John, as they rededicated the temple. And Jesus was there in the temple in Solomon's porch. And the Jews came to him. They asked him, how long dost thou make us to doubt? If thou be the Messiah, the Christ, tell us plainly. And Jesus said, I told you, and you believe not. The works that I do in my Father's name, they bear witness of me. But ye believe not, because ye are not of my sheep. As I said, my sheep hear my voice, and I know them, and they follow me, and I give unto them eternal life, and they shall never perish, neither shall any man pluck them out of my Father, out of my hand. My Father, which gave them me, is greater than all. No man is able to pluck them out of my Father's hand. I and my Father are one. And here Jesus is dedicating the fact that the oil will stay at the Feast of Dedication. He's telling them right there, one of the great teachings in the Bible Jesus does to celebrate this. So that is the history. Now we'll go back to Daniel 11 because we have enough history. And basically, Daniel was given a preview of this in the 11th chapter, that these things were going to happen, that they would, verse 31, place the abomination that maketh desolate. They would desolate the temple. They'd put the swine's blood there. They would do wickedly against the covenant that God had given. I would corrupt many of the Jews by flatteries, come to my side. But the people that do know their God, end of verse 32, shall be strong like Mattathias and his five sons. They shall do exploits, and they that understand among the people shall instruct many, and that's what they did. Yet they shall fall by the sword. There are many that died by the flame, by captivity, by spoil, not many days. When they do fall, they shall be helped up with a little help, but many will cleave to them with flatteries. The difference in verse 34, very carefully, not only is it a near-term prophecy there, it's a far-term prophecy, because what God is going to begin to do here is he's going to merge the rest of this chapter all the way through verse 45 with the time of the end. End of verse 35. For yet for a time appointed. And he's going to move from what happened with Antiochus to the Antichrist himself in verse 36. And what you're seeing here is when the Antichrist takes over, and he places the final abomination that makes desolate in verse 31. And he again will do wickedly against the covenant. And go to the book of Revelation chapter. I got off the top of my head, I'm not sure where it is. 11. Chapter 11. Now there's going to be a lot of cross-referencing between Daniel 11 and Revelation. And we'll get into it when we study Revelation. I'll just give you a little preview today on what's going on. In Revelation 11, when John is beginning to see what's happening toward the tribulation time, it says in verse 1, there was given me a reed, like unto a rod, and the angel said, rise and measure the temple of God and the altar and them that worship therein, but the court, which is without the temple, leave it out and measure it not, for it is given to the Gentiles, and the holy city shall they tread underfoot 42 months. And what's going to happen is they're going to make the abomination that's desolate. They're going to take away the sacrifice. They're going to do wickedly against the covenant. They're going to corrupt Jews by flatteries. And what's going to happen, those that know their God and be strong and do exploits, like you saw in Daniel 11:32, back then it was Judas Maccabee, now it's going to be the 144,000. And the 144,000 and the two witnesses are going to come forth. And they will, they that understand among the people, they'll instruct many. And they're going to go out and they're going to teach. Yet they'll fall, and we know the two witnesses will be killed at the end. And some of the 144,000 will fall, although Jesus will resurrect them. They'll be helping. Now, verse 34 is an interesting one in Daniel, because when they fall, they shall be hoping or helped with a little help. That's one group of people, help them. But many will not. They'll cleave to them with flatteries and not help them. And that's when Jesus says, when I come back, I will divide the sheep from the goats. And the sheep are the ones that you helped, my brethren. You visited my brethren. You cared for my brethren, Matthew 25. And the goats are the ones that you may have given lip service, but you turned them in. And that's the division that's going on there. Verse 36, and then the whole prophecy breaks now to the time of the Antichrist, and the king shall do according to his will. This is the Antichrist. 2 Thessalonians chapter 2, the man of sin, the son of perdition, the one that will sit in the temple. He shall exalt himself. He shall magnify himself above every god. He shall speak marvelous things against the God of gods and shall prosper till the indignation be accomplished. And the indignation against God will go so long. God's got it measured. It's an 84-month period. And then he's going to send his angels back, the reapers, and they will gather the chaff together and to be bound in bundles and to be burned. For that is determined shall be done. God has determined what is going to happen. I have Jeremiah 15, verse 10 for a reference. I'm not sure what it says. Let me just look. Something I must have written years ago. Jeremiah 15:10. It's just one of the Jews. Woe is me, my mother, thou hast borne me, a man of strife, a man of contention to the whole earth. Yeah, because the Antichrist is going to have some Jewish blood in him. He's going to be part Syrian, part Jew. I don't know how much Jew. The requirements now in Israel for being admitted as a Jew, and they, I can't remember the word they use, but all Jews are supposedly freely welcome to come back to their homeland, and they're not going to have to go through all kinds of stuff like if you want to come to America and be an American citizen. And all they need to prove is one of four grandparents is Jewish. And if any one of the four grandparents is Jewish, that is sufficient for them to be a Jewish Israeli citizen. And that's, it's been like that since 1948. So I have a feeling this Antichrist will probably have one-fourth of his heritage will be Jewish. And back to where we are in Daniel 11 about this, because it says in verse 37, neither shall he regard the God of his fathers. That's his Jewish heritage, because it's a capital G. Nor will he regard the desire of women. He most likely will be an LGBT. Why do I know that? Do you remember in Revelation chapter 6, verse 1 and 2? He comes out with a bow in his hand. What's the symbol for the LGBT? The rainbow. The first time the bow is in the Bible, that's God giving the rainbow, talking about mercy to the earth. These people have stolen the bow to let abominations be committed on the earth. And so he will not regard the desire of women, nor regard any god. He shall magnify himself above all. The cross reference there, of course, is 2 Thessalonians chapter 2. When he will oppose, verse 4, and exalt himself above all that's called God, or anything that's worshipped, and he as God will sit in the temple of God, showing himself that he is God. And the man of sin is basically fulfilling what the devil promised them. You'll be as gods. And that's pretty much the desire of most people. Matter of fact, I've often thought it was kind of curious. A lot of the teaching of the New Age is that you have a God inside of you. If you just come to realize that you are at one with God, you've got God inside of you. And if you listen to them, that everybody is a God except for Jesus Christ. He's the only one that's not God. No, he's just a man. But the rest of you, you're all God. If you've ever paid attention to the teaching, and you better not to, my recommendation is to watch Netflix. But just pay attention. You hear that. He'll magnify himself above all. Verse 38, this Antichrist, in his estate shall he honor the God of forces. He may talk about love, but he knows the only way to get people to obey him is through force and power and putting people on a rack and pulling their fingernails out and fear. And incidentally, it breaks my heart, but sadly, that's what works with people. People respond to fear and force before they respond to love. As a matter of fact, you're going to read about, I got a verse in the Psalms where God, it says, thy people shall be willing in the day of thy power. Because God himself realized it. No offense, I hope there's some Christians listening out there. You know, God does love you, but you don't love him back. I've met Christians, they don't love God. I know that. Look, I won't even say that I love God. I can't say it, honestly. I can't. I kind of know who he is, love his book. I can't say I love him. I'm not going to lie to you. I'm sorry. But everyone else I met loves God. Every Christian I've talked to, oh, yeah, he's a Christian. He loves God. Oh, she loves God. Yeah, well, you can tell by the way they live they don't love God. And God knows the only way I'm going to get these Christians in line is when I take over by power. And I too. Now, thankfully, God's power is a good power. The Antichrist isn't. And the devil knows people respond to force. How do you think they got people in gulags in the Soviet Union? We love you. Would you please come to our gulag? Okay. All right. Yeah. I'm sorry to have to teach you human nature and true psychology, but somebody ought to. You should have been learning this stuff in middle school and high school. No, it's about time someone teaches truth. In his estate he'll honor the God of forces. And a God whom his fathers knew not shall he honor with gold and silver and precious stones and pleasant things. Thus shall he do in the most strongholds with a strange God, whom he shall acknowledge and increase with glory. And he shall cause them to rule over many and shall divide the land, that's of Israel, for gain. And God doesn't want his land divided. And God doesn't like the Gaza Strip. And God doesn't like the West Bank. And God doesn't like a two-state solution. God says, that's my land. Nobody has the right to be on it. No sinner has the right to. By the way, anybody know the first time in your Bible the word holy is found? No, no. It's not found in Genesis. I'll show you the first time the word holy is found. Go to Exodus 3. And Moses came to the mountain of God. Verse 1. End of the verse. And the angel of the Lord appeared to him in a flame of fire out of the midst of a bush. And Moses looked, and behold, the bush was burned with fire. The bush was not consumed. And Moses said, I'll turn aside and see this great sight, why the bush is not burned. And when the Lord saw, he turned aside to see. God called to him out of the bush and said, Moses, Moses, he said, here am I. He said, draw not nigh hither. Put off thy shoes from off thy feet, for the place wherein thou standest is holy ground. And God is holy, and that's his land, and that ground is holy, and no sinner has a right to walk on it. No Muslim, no Catholic, no Far Eastern thing that the Beatles ran around with the long robes. No, that's God's land. And back to where we are, and they're going to try and divide the land, God's land, for gain. And God doesn't go for that. Back to where we are in Daniel 11. And at that time, verse 40, what is going to happen is, even during the time of the Antichrist, and we will study this, the king of the south shall push at him, and the king of the north shall come against him like a whirlwind. And I know we tend to think in a shallow manner, well, he's ruling the whole world, and the whole world loves him. No, they don't love him. Most people hate him, are afraid of him. And there are pockets of resistance and nations that fight against him. He's ruling, let's say, the part of the civilized world around the Middle East. But other people from the east, from the north, from the south are going to fight against him. He's going to be ruling the world in the way that during the time of the first coming, Caesar, let's say, ruled the world. But he had enemies fighting him on all different areas. And he had Roman guards fighting in all places. Within his empire, he had control. But outside, there were border skirmishes going on all the time. You can read history books about it. And that's how it's going to be at this time, too. And there's going to be whirlwinds and chariots and horsemen and many ships. By the way, he talks about chariots and horsemen. And that's exactly what it's going to be. Well, it's going to be tanks and helicopters. I think I've been to tanks and helicopters. In the first 3.5 years, God's going to shut down all technology. That's it. Exodus 12, verse 12. Exodus 12, verse 12. And I can show you other ones, but that's the simplest one. And Job 5, verse 12, and there's other ones too. And we can look at other places in Proverbs. But one of the things God is going to do in this battle, the battle that God had with the Pharaoh back in the day, is a picture of the battle he's going to have with the Antichrist, and the judgments he brought on Egypt back to let his people free are going to be the same type of judgments he brings on the Antichrist to let his people free for the final time so that they can be in the millennium with his son. And verse 12, He is going to pass through the land of Egypt. At that time will be the land of the Antichrist. And he will smite all the firstborn in the land, man and beast. And against all the gods of Egypt, I will execute judgment. I am the Lord. And sadly, for the last 100 years, the greatest gods of Egypt, the modern world, is science and technology. Science and technology. And that is what convinced the world that they don't need God. I was watching just yesterday a History Channel talking about the development of the steam engine and then the steam locomotive, and watching all this and realizing that the beginning of the industrialization is what brought all these people together in the world, and they no longer needed God. They no longer needed the Bible, because everything could be provided by industrialism and automatic technology, and that's where they are. And God's going to take that away real fast. And they'll be back in chariots and horses and horsemen and old-fashioned ships. And the rest of the chapter is just showing the battle that's going to come in the Antichrist. We'll study that. And the chapter ends with he'll plant the tabernacles of his palace between the seas in the holy mountain. And what he's going to do, he's going to try and plant. He's going to finally take Israel for a short period of time. It's given to the Gentiles between the seas. That's the Mediterranean Sea and the Sea of Galilee in the glorious holy mountain. Yet he shall come to his end. And when he comes to his end, no one is going to help him, because his battle's against God and there's no one he can call on. And that's how it's going to end. So I don't like particularly studying the Antichrist. I've read the Bible 60 times through, and I kind of read right past the Antichrist things. I don't like studying it. I don't like cross-referencing. I like cross-referencing David, Jesus, Peter, Paul. But I never really enjoyed studying the Antichrist. If you like it, one of the guys that was brilliant at it was Dr. Peter S. Ruckman. And you can read his book, The Mark of the Beast, and you can go online and see his stuff on the Antichrist. And he's got great cross-references. His mind really picks that stuff up. Mine doesn't. I don't care. I'm not going to be here when he rules. When I come back with the Lord, he's gone and done away with. He's been put down with the false prophet and Satan into the pit and shut up, and so I don't have to worry about it. But what is happening here is, after giving all this, like 170, 200, 300 years of prophecy up till verse 35, for the time appointed, from verse 36 to 45, it kicks into Revelation, and those 11 or 12 verses, or 10 verses, are all about the end. When his 10-toed empire is ruling things. And I don't like it. So I don't particularly study it that much. I just know it's coming, and I won't be here, and it's going to be over when I get back. Yes, brother, in the back. Yeah. Well, he's calling himself God. Remember in 2 Thessalonians chapter 2, so that he as God, read it, 2 Thessalonians 2, I think it's verse 4 or 5. Read what he calls himself. He refers to himself as God with a capital G. Which verse is it, brother? 4 or 5, I can't remember. 2 Thessalonians 2, either verse 4 or 5. I don't know. 4, there it is. 2:2:4, and there he is. And he calls himself God. So he's known as the God, not of love, but of forces. So all this talk about love, the songs will be changed real quickly when he's in power. And that will be it. Yes.